What is happening, everybody? Welcome back to Tour Life. Today is Tuesday, March 19th. We are going to jump in to the recap of the Open at the Open at Austin. Talk all about what went down in MPO, what went down in FPO. We actually have the Open at Austin first time on Tour Life joining us. Niklas Antila joins the show. Niklas Antila. I've heard so many different pronunciations. We will get the official pronunciation. We'll get the official one tonight when he joins the show. We did reach out to Owen. I want to let everyone know we did reach out to Owen. She did not see my Instagram DM. Yuli, you tried to reach out to her as well?
I've tried before. She's busy. She's a busy gal.
So yeah, I was gonna say
she's a tough get. We'll eventually get her though.
We'll get her. We didn't get her this week, but
she told me before she needs a little planning, and yeah. I'm like, well, we can't plan when you win. Like we can't do that.
Maybe we should. We'll get into that very soon here. We also have the wild story of the week. We're gonna be bumping up Edwin's stats too, because I feel like. Edwin made a good point. He said, hey, a lot of the stats I have are stuff that you've already kind of discussed. So we're going to actually talk about Edwin's stats almost at the top of the show to give us a little bit more context on some things that we can talk about in the recap and then also talk about when Niklas comes on. So I think that'll be a good move. And then we've got some listener questions to end out the show. Big show. But before we get into it, we do have a ad. So Silas, let's roll into that right now.
Today's video is sponsored by Mudwater. All right, as some of you may know, I recently had a newborn baby, and with that comes lack of sleep and the need for energy. And here's the thing, energy drinks are not the best solution. All that caffeine can make you jittery, it can get you some serious crashes, and that's why Mudwater is an excellent alternative. Mudwater is super, super simple to make, and it gives a great boost of energy with natural ingredients. Each ingredient in this blend was added for a purpose. They've got cacao and chai for a hint of caffeine and a little bit of that hot chocolate flavor. Lion's mane for focus, cordyceps to promote natural energy, and both chaga and reishi to support a healthy immune system. Now, I know what you're thinking. Natural energy made up of mushrooms called mud water. How does it taste? I actually quite like it. I think it kind of tastes like a chai tea latte, which I really love. Like any kind of healthier beverage, it was a little intimidating at first, but once I tried it, I realized I loved it. Making it is super easy. You just take a scoop of your mud water. I like to throw it in some hot water and then mix it up. Like I said, has a great taste. I think those of you who are coffee drinkers could find this as an easy alternative. You still get that warm, yummy beverage. You can make this a ton of different ways. They offer other products like creamers as well to help sweeten things up. And I really like it just as it is as well.
Smells good.
Yeah, it does. Plus, this thing is healthy, okay? This is certified USDA organic. It's Whole30 approved. It's vegan approved. It's gluten-free. It really checks all those boxes. So if you're looking to kick the energy drinks, find an alternative to that coffee and those jittery moments and those crashes that are associated with it, like I was being sleep deprived with a newborn baby, Mudwater is a special offer that they're hooking up with our viewers with. If you go to mudwater.com/foundation, you can get started for just $29. That's Mudwater spelled MUDWTR.com/foundation. You can get started for just $29. Thanks again to Mudwater for sponsoring this video. I'm going to enjoy this mug. Bye.
Ever for that, and thank you, Mudwater, for sponsoring the Tour Life podcast. We appreciate all of our sponsors. All right, Yuli, how's it going, brother?
It's off good. Week. I'm back home, man. I'm so happy to be home.
It's so nice.
It's crazy how you can kind of compartmentalize everything while you're on tour, and it just seems like another day, another whatever. And then literally every time I come home, I'm dead. Like I walk in the door, I literally, you know, have like a later flight because we're all the way across the country. So I get in at like 8, I come home, go upstairs and I sleep for like 14 hours. It's crazy.
Oh, really?
Almost every time. Like it's as soon as I get home, I'm able to just like crash out and finally get some sleep. And like nothing changes. The schedule's still the same. It's just, I don't know. My brain's finally like, okay, we're home. Like let's digress a little bit.
Yeah, it's super nice. And, you know, obviously being a married man yourself, you sleep easier when you're back at home.
Yes.
With the wife and everything. Mm-hmm. So It is very nice. It's a nice little off week here leading into Texas State's next week, which will be out in Houston. But yeah, this past week, we were down in Austin, Texas, which I have to say, timing wise, I don't know if I love the idea of having the tournament during South by Southwest. I think you probably have a lot of maybe your fringe disc golf fans deciding to probably go to South by Southwest over a disc golf tournament. But that being said, I think Austin is an absolutely awesome spot for a disc golf pro tour event. And I'm very happy with, even though I love the tournament in Belton and I thought it was a cool course and they were doing a lot of awesome things to kind of make that course more pro tour standards, if you will, I think what they've done down here in Austin and the fans, it's been awesome. It's been really, really nice.
No, I agree. I think the fans were great. The course was pretty good. I'm looking forward to the next couple of years, hopefully staying in one spot and getting that course kind of dialed down. Because
that was their plan all along, by the way.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if some people I saw on the internet were saying like, oh, it's nice that the course designers saw some player feedback and may change. No. I talked to the course designer. He said this was the plan all along, was to get in the woods to make these holes. It's just they didn't have enough time to do it last year. So I think we're going to start seeing more and more improvements, which, I mean, these guys know what they're doing. They make good holes, and I'm very excited. Like you said, hopefully this tournament stays in one spot.
Yeah,
and we can kind of see it grow year after year. But how did your week go down at the Open at Austin?
It was good. It was a little disappointing. I went into the week playing really well. I felt like that. I don't think there's a course that's better for me than that one, honestly, out there. And I had another like little slip on a tee pad in practice and tweaked my left glute. So I couldn't throw very many sidearms, like no power sidearms at all, which is like, if you play that front nine, it's all sidearms pretty much. It's once you get in the woods for me, you can get away with throwing backhands as we saw a lot of great players do. Mm-hmm. But for me, like practicing it, I was throwing stock little Raptor flexes on like all those position holes to get into position and my upshots and everything. And so that really hurt me. I came out of the front nine, I think for the tournament, 6 over par, which that's not getting the job done. And I played the back nine extremely well, which I didn't think was my strong nine. And that was pretty much it. I mean, I really feel like I've been throwing my sidearms better than I have in years. So that was kind of a big blow to me. It was doing really well at Waco and at the Memorial. So that was basically it. I ended up tying like 75 people for last cash, which I thought that I was tied for one out of the cash. So it's funny how after the tournament you can be all bummed and then you find out you made $95 and you're oh, sweet. I kind of did it this weekend. So there was a small bright spot there. It was great because I know what I need to work on. I think as we move forward in the year, courses are going to get longer. And with that, I don't have to rely on my sidearm as much. And I know what I have to work on with like my backhand and the control that I need to get with certain shots, because there are a couple holes out there that required some nice distance and some controlled like flex shots and stuff. But yeah, that was it. I was happy with my play. I putted great again. I just need to kind of have it all come together. I think I'm really close to having a great tournament.
Oh, that's fantastic. Before the show started, we kind of talked a little bit how, you know, Friday was a pretty big wake-up call for me because it was very calm. I got into town on Wednesday, so I got a practice round in on Wednesday and one in on Thursday. And both those days were fairly calm. And the wind picked up drastically on Friday. It also switched directions of where we were usually practicing. And I got a very rude awakening of like, holy crap, I don't really know, or at least maybe not know is the right word. Maybe I didn't have the confidence in a lot of my discs on what they were going to do in the wind. Because I think when the wind gets that high, you really want to be throwing discs that you like, I know for a fact this is not going to flip.
Yep.
Because it gets really scary when you're like, I'm 50-50. So there was a lot of shots where I was like, I don't actually know what disc to throw. And so that was a little bit frustrating at times. But again, like the frustration, I can always just put it back to myself. So it's not a crazy thing. It's something that I can work out with time. The other thing about this tournament that I was at least kind of working on a little bit is I was working on shots that I'm not very good at. So the straight standstill putter shot from 200 feet where you have to throw it through a gap, that is not my bread and butter. I would much rather be throwing a crazy scramble shot where I'm leaning out, throwing a sidearm yeah. through a gap. I feel like I'm going to hit that gap way more consistent that way than the backhand. So I was working on some of those backhand putter shots, and then hole 17, that might be the worst shape shot for me ever, because you can't really get to the basket with a forehand flip up the way that the trees are aligned. Yeah. It is, and it's not really a throw a flippy disc. It is 100% throw an overstable disc on a flex line backhand. And that is by far my worst shot. And so the first 2 days I was like, I'm doing this. And I early released one straight OB left, took a double. The other one, I hit the tree that you're trying to miss. You know, you're trying to turn off that tree, hit that tree, went OB. I think I took a bogey. I think I got up and down for a bogey. So the first 2 days I was like, I'm not playing well. On this hole. Third day, I was like, I'm doing it. And I literally grabbed my disc and didn't take any time at all. I was just like locked in on this is what I'm doing. I didn't do any routine. Grabbed my disc from the bag, walked up, ran up through it, threw it to like 27 feet. And I was like, heck yeah, that is how you throw that shot. Now, can I replicate it? That is the question. But I thought this course was great. I thought it required a lot of different shots. The scrambling was really fun on a lot of these wooded holes. And then some of these open holes, you know, you look at a hole like hole number 10. This was the hole that Niklas aced, Austin Turner aced, and
Trevin
Crow aced as well. So three aces on the hole, and you think to yourself, oh my gosh, this is the easiest hole ever. No. That hole played very difficult for a lot of people.
Yes.
And it required a very specific shot depending on what the wind was. Now, did we like the drop zone there, Yuli?
No.
Like a 35-foot putt for par. I didn't like it, but a hole that you would look at normally on paper and be like, oh, this is like a must-get birdie. It wasn't. That was a challenging hole. So I like the way the course was set up this year. I think it's heading in the right direction. I will say that I don't know if we want to get into this right now. I did play the wrong drop zone and ended up taking a penalty stroke or two penalty strokes on one of the holes. Should we have literally a painted area and a sign that says drop zone that actually isn't our drop zone?
What was it a drop zone for?
FPO.
Oh, well,
now I get it. Should, it's on me.
It should say MPO or FPO on there. It should be like MPO drop zone, FPO drop zone for sure.
It shouldn't just be
a drop zone. No,
it's on me. Was I kind of making a point? Maybe in the time I was kind of making a point of like, why do we have to play every hole and look at the caddy book to read the paragraph on how that hole plays? To me, there should be like a standardized rule of like how holes play. And we shouldn't like have to always be like, do we go to the FPO tee pad for the drop zone? Or do we go to this drop zone for the drop zone? Do we advance if we cross OB, or do we have, I don't know. And maybe I'm on my pace of play rant again, but I do think that affects pace of play is when every hole plays a little bit different from one another.
No, I think, I mean, it's tough because the facts are we play the same course that's different. Play on the same property that's different. So we're playing with two courses set up at all times. The basket's just not in. So there's all kinds of different T-pads. There's all kinds of different drop zones. There's all kinds of different Mandos. There's all kinds of different drop zones for that Mando. Like, it can be definitely confusing. And I think standardizing it would be amazing. Are we there yet? Probably not. But at least have like MPO on the drop zone, MPO drop zone, FPO drop zone. That's pretty easy. I love
the different color T-pads too at Lake Waco. That was nice.
Different color T-pads, whatever. All those things are super important. And it can definitely get confusing. I mean, there's people in my group who didn't know where to go or what to do. And
for me too,
there's a lot of provisionals being played.
Yes. Yes. And this isn't like a gripe on like, I was so far out of cash. I didn't care if I was going to take a penalty stroke. A lot of this is, it's like spectators.
Yeah.
Right. Of like, it's confusing of like, what's going, why, wait, what's happening. And you know, if this happened on coverage, who knows? What were you going to say though?
I was going to say the provisional is a rule you can use to your advantage, which goes into this, which I saw a lot of comments in our last podcast about me not knowing the rules about benefit goes to the player.
Hold on that, because we're going to, unless you want to talk about it now, I was going to add, we had a listener question that I think sums that up really well that I want you to respond to if you're okay with waiting. It's up to you though.
Ooh, I'm gonna gripe, but okay, yeah. I'll wait.
Should I ask the question now and then you can respond? Yeah. How about that?
Yes, please.
Okay. This is from William. He says, it sounds like Yuli does not have the correct understanding of the benefit goes to the player rule based on the last episode. The rule states when a group cannot reach a majority decision regarding a ruling, the ruling is based on the interpretation that is most beneficial to the thrower. It does not establish a certain level of confidence required before voting yes or no. If player A throws out of bounds and players B, C, D are 50% sure you never crossed in bounds, they can still vote that way, and that is the ruling player A has to go with. Do you two think that rule should be updated to support Yuli's opinion of the rule?
It is supporting my opinion. This is what's hilarious. People listen to what I say and they're like, oh my gosh, 1% goes to the benefit goes to the player. It's 100% true, because here's the thing. If we don't see the disc cross in bounds, nobody has an opinion. Nobody can be like, no, I for sure saw it. Like, that's a thing. It's a spotter says it, there's a spotter there because it's hard for us to tell. Mm-hmm. If I'm in a group, which I am, and you guys aren't, this is the way that it works. I go, wow, I'm pretty sure I crossed. If I think I crossed, damn near 100% of the time, my group is going to be on board with me. Dang near. How many times, Brody, have you thrown a shot and been like, I think I crossed, and your whole group's like, not even close, dude. Scram. It doesn't happen like that. Like, that's not a real scenario that happens in our game. In real life scenarios, when you're having a disagreement with, it's typically a spotter. It's usually not your group, because we're all on the same board of being like, no, benefit goes to the player. Like, it was pretty close. Like, you probably get it. And once in a while, there's one person. I have never been in a group where three people told me no chance, and I argued. I go like this. All right, deal. Done. I'm taking it back here. I don't have an argument, right? But when there's a discrepancy, the benefit goes to the player. Even if it is 1%, 1%.
Yeah, it might not be technically, I guess, with what William's saying is it might not be technically what the rule says, but the way that it works on the pro tour and like how, you know, we all play with you one other, you know, week after week. If we're not 100% sure, if we can't say, no, man, I saw that disc hit the water, it never crossed. If we can't say that, the majority of players on tour are going to say, well, we'll say you crossed. That's just how it works. Now, the one thing that I always push back on is if we are standing, hole 18 is a perfect example at Waco. Everyone knows that hole. The spotter is standing on the shoreline. Yeah. They're looking down the shoreline. We are at an angle to the shoreline. Our vantage point, also, we're, you know, 400 feet away. The spotter's 50 to 100 feet away. They're much closer. They have a much better view of what the disc is doing than us. So the way I always do it is like, I'm just going to have faith and trust in what the spotter saw. because if I can't say one way or the other because of the way of where I'm standing and the spotter's telling me you 100% did not cross, I have to have faith and trust that that spotter is calling it the same way for every player. And if we all take the spotter's ruling in that situation, now it's different though, Yuli. If that spotter is 250 feet away and has a bad vantage point, then I think it's up for grabs. But if he's standing on the line and he's literally looking to see like if your disc that's where I have an issue. When a player walks up and is like, no chance, look where my disc is. There's no chance it didn't cross. It's like, bro, this guy's saying it didn't cross. I don't know what you want me to say.
And it comes
down
to the group too. Like the spotter has nothing to do with it. Literally nothing. If you don't want them to, it's the group. And when that stuff happens and you look at your group and you go, I think I crossed. Typically, first of all, not a lot of people pay attention anyway. And there's going to be one guy who says, didn't see it. And there's going to be another guy who says, I don't think you crossed. And then another guy goes, I don't know. And then it's a spotter against me, against that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's the way that it works. In that situation, benefit goes to the player. So when I hear all these comments about Paul doesn't know the rules, no, I've played more tournaments than any person has ever played on the Pro Tour. That's fact. I have experience with this stuff. That's not how it works. The rule can read the way it reads, but in certain situations, it's a lot harder than you think. And in those cases, I would rather have benefit go to the player than the opposite. Period. Because then you can completely flip the script and be like, okay, so if you know that it crosses 100% and 100 people see it and you have people in your group telling you you didn't cross and you actually did, now you're getting screwed and it's fine. So it's a rule. It's a rule that is like, it's not as easy as people think. It's not black and white at all.
And we also take, you know, we take spectators and fans sometimes, right? We'll walk up and if someone's like, oh yeah, you definitely cross in bounds, that even though that shouldn't have any impact on our vote of whether or not it did cross in bounds, it does. If you 100%. Walk up in a spot and you hear a spotter say, oh yeah, he definitely crossed in bounds, it's really hard at that point to be like, no, man, I don't think you crossed the bounds.
Exactly. So, yeah. I mean, there was last year at the Memorial, I threw a shot on hole one. Didn't look like it crossed at all. We get up there. I play provisional from the drop zone, get up there. The spotter goes, Paul, you 100% cross in bounds. And my group's like, dude, that wasn't even close. And he goes, I've been sitting here all day. I saw it crest right here. It was a good 3 feet in bounds. And my group's like, okay, so he takes it here then. I'm like,
yeah, heck yeah. It's tough not to.
You know,
it's really tough. You normally don't ever see that get reversed. The ones that you see get reversed is when the spotter is saying you did not cross, and the player's fighting for you did cross. That's because you're never going to disagree with the spotter and be like, no, I definitely didn't cross, right? You're always gonna be like, well, if the spotter is saying I crossed, I guess I crossed. And it's the opposite, which is, I think that's the one that I have the biggest disagreement.
And what I was explaining last week, and I'll restate it again. If you think your disc cross and the spotter says no, that's when I say, are you 100% sure it didn't cross? And if he says,
spotter?
Yeah. And if he says no, then he's void. He's void.
Yeah,
and
now I guess,
that's the 1%. You go, are you 100% sure that it didn't cross? And if he goes, it was pretty close. All of a sudden, now benefit goes to the player in your group, right? Because he has the best vantage point. You look at your group, you can't really see it. And now you have an argument.
Yeah.
That's the way that works.
Yeah. All right. We have Niklas coming in about 5 minutes or so. But before we get him on here, I want to let you guys know that something that we're doing over at Foundation Disc Golf, we're testing this out. We're seeing how it goes. And so far, the people that have joined have really enjoyed it. So I wanted to share that with you guys. We are thrilled to introduce our exclusive weekly text deals that offer incredible discounts on your favorite discs, merch, and accessories. Get ready to score amazing savings and elevate your collection. Each week, our team handpicks from our inventory or places a specific order to find the best deal we can possibly offer. We text you a limited time offer on hand selected items. text us back with how many of the discs slash item you want, and your order is in. It's just that easy. If you're on your phone, click the link in the description or text the word join to 1-833-255-8270. Text the word join to 1-833-255-8270 and you will get signed up today. And you know, if you love great deals on discs, that's where you'll just have them literally texted to your phone. Did I throw that in the description, Silas, or do I need to do that right now? I don't remember if I threw that in there. All right, I will add that in to all of our YouTube people right now so you guys have that in the description. I can put this actually right here for you guys in chat too. There you go. Boom. Get some cool deals texted your way. All right. Anything else, Yuli, to wrap up your Waco experience? Or sorry, gosh, Waco. Your open at Austin.
No, that was it, man. I had a blast. It was a good week.
Were you affected by the delay on Sunday at all?
I mean, I had to wait for my tee time, but not really.
You hadn't teed off yet? You got pushed back?
No, I just got pushed back, so I didn't have to go out there and come off or anything. But, I mean, it was weird not being able to play all the holes. I will give a shout-out to whoever said get rid of the three holes because that was perfect for the ending. Almost. It could have been two holes, but them getting rid of the three holes, it seemed like it timed pretty well for the whole tournament to be able to finish. It was like,
yeah, right. I don't know how much more time they would have had.
It was
getting pretty dark.
Because at first I'm like, dude, they're going to be able to finish the whole thing. Why can't we just play all the holes? I was thinking. And
lead card was pretty far behind every other card.
Yeah.
So they were a good two cards behind. The funny thing about that, we'll talk about this a little bit later on after Niklas gets off, but there was a funny I don't know if you saw that interaction between Austin Hannum and Jeff Spring, where I think I was on the second or third card out that final day, and we were like, if we skip these holes, because FPO wasn't skipping, FPO played all 18, we're like, we're gonna jump FPO. Like we'll skip because that is an issue. That is an issue that they need to figure out. Is FPO almost every day blocks up the entire course. So MPO catches up with lead card FPO almost every round. And I would know because I'm playing a lot of times on these cards that are catching up to FBO. So that is something that they're going to have to try to figure out of how do we get these rounds done quicker, because you know, we can't be having some cards playing around in 3.5 hours and some cards playing around in 3 hours. It's just not going to work. All right. Edwin's stats. I don't know if I really want to jump too much into this before we get Niklas on, because he's about to jump. So I think we maybe do, or maybe we can kind of discuss some of this stuff while Niklas jumps on, because a lot of this stuff honestly is from him. So we can maybe use some of this stuff. We can maybe use some. I'll maybe pull some of this stuff up when we're talking about it, because some of this stuff actually here is very, very exciting. But we're not going to make him wait any longer. The first ever Finnish player to win on the Disc Golf Pro Tour, Niklas Anttila, now joins Tour Life for the first time. Welcome, brother.
Sounds good. Thank you, boys.
I was going to say, how's that intro sound?
Very nice. That has been my dream for like four years now, and it's finally true, so I still can't believe it, but I think I start to like understand what happened and move forward.
Yeah, that's one of those cool ones that will stick with you for the rest of time and even like in the future, you know, 40 years, 50 years from now, if another Finnish player starts making moves on the tour, everyone will look back to you as the first. So you're kind of cemented into history there winning that one. So
yeah.
Very, very cool. I want to jump in first to just kind of get your mindset because this isn't new to you having a chance to win. You've been in positions multiple times, and multiple times you've fallen just short. Yeah. What was the feeling going into the lead round? Did you have any feelings like, hey, this is different?
Yeah, obviously I was second last week in Waco as well. So I kind of fell short again, and I felt like, all right, we had one more second place again. And I was just telling myself that I just can't keep like being second all the time. If I get like any more chances, I want to dig deep and like take all my chances and use them as my advantage. And of course, I missed the putt on 14 again. And I was feeling like, is it happening again? But I was able to make those two putts in the last two holes and win it. Like, if I think like how I want to win like by making a 35 footer. So that was super nice.
Yeah, it was very impressive what you did. We'll get to that in a second. I don't want to jump too far ahead because some crazy stuff happened in a very, very short period of time. I'm trying to get the timeline just right, and Yuli or either one of you, I guess, jump in. You got a warning for excessive time, which has now happened twice. Back-to-back tournaments, lead card, Gannon Burr at Waco, and now you at the Open at Austin. And then did you end up missing a kind of a short putt shortly after that?
Yeah, I got the time warning on round one. I think it was hole 8 on my second shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I was playing a bit faster after that. And I was kind of rushing my shots, I felt like. And I missed like maybe like 14, 15 foot putt on hole 9. So, yeah. It was in my mind that I need to play fast, and I didn't want to even come close to 30 seconds and any of my shots. But yeah, and then on hole 10, I played one hole in 10 seconds, so that was fast.
Yeah, so for those that didn't see it, we'll actually pull up the clip here in a second. Not yet right now, Size, because I do want to get your thoughts on that. But this brings up my like pace of play situation. I'm curious to see what your thoughts are on it. I think the 30-second rule is one of the dumbest rules we play, and I'll tell you why. You could have all four people on your card take 29 seconds for every single shot. They have a 5-foot putt. They take 29 seconds. You could do that, and there would be no rules that you could call against this card. They're playing by the rules, and they would back up the entire course. It would be an absolute nightmare to play behind a card like that. So like what you just said, you started playing a lot quicker and you took 10 seconds to play one hole. Do you like the way the rule is currently set, or would you like to make it to where, hey, there's certain shots that I'm going to need a little bit more time, but when I get to a 20-foot putt, I'm not going to take 30 seconds. I'm going to take 10. And that's going to kind of catch us back up to how fast we should be playing.
Yeah, I think especially in disc golf, if you go to like deep rough, you will easily take like 45 seconds on a shot. But then again, if you have like a 250-foot hyzer shot, like nothing on your way, I think you should take like only 10, 15 seconds to maybe look at the wind and stuff. I don't know what I think about like the 30-second rule. I think it's all right, but there is definitely like situations where it's really bad as well. And for me, it's just like, because I got the time warning from like DGPT staff member, not a player.
Yeah.
And then I was not the only one using like over 30 seconds on one shot. And the same guy was there for the whole round, and I was the only guy who got the warning. So I think that's like, I felt a little bit dumb about that, because especially with the same guy being like following us on the whole round.
Yeah. I think the clip that, or the shot that you ended up getting it, I think you ended up taking roughly around 50 seconds. And yeah, it's like, the rule is, if we're really calling the rules out here, like you said, any time over 30 seconds should be called, whether it's 31, 32 or a minute and a half. And Gannon was on last week, and he was talking how he was asking the guy, like, when does my 30 seconds start? Like, I would like to know when my 30 seconds, and the guy couldn't give him a clear answer. And I think that's a big issue too. A lot of people are looking specifically on how long, you know, how long are you taking to throw your shot, right? Are you doing a bunch of pump fakes? And my thing is, like, I actually don't think that's the big issue here. I think the big issue is, how long are you staying on the tee pad and talking before the next person's throwing? How long is it taking you to walk 450 feet to your tee shot? Like, are you just walking the park doing this? Because I can get to my tee shot in 20 seconds, and there might be some people taking a minute, and that's those are massive gaps. Yuli, what are your thoughts on how, you know, do you like the 30 second rule, or do you think what needs to be changed? Because we're seeing it now affecting multiple tournaments.
Yeah, I can't stand it. One of the things is, I think we should all get like a minute. I think there should be a minute, because then it wouldn't even matter. And I think you should get an extension of your minute as well. And I've had a lot of pushback of that, people being like, a minute, that's crazy. And I'm like, yeah, but people are taking a minute anyway. That's my whole thing. Like, I don't have a problem with taking 30 seconds to throw. I'm a fairly quick player. But there's times when the wind picks up and I'm putting where I'll use a little extra time, and I don't get called for it because I'm typically a quick player, and I'm not sitting there counting. Like, I have an internal clock that's like, okay, this is taking a little bit. This is taking a little while. I should probably pull the trigger. And then I do, you know, once that internal clock is like, okay, I'm taking the excessive time. I have that. I think every player has that. And if it was a minute, we wouldn't have to worry about it. And then it comes down to what I think, if you had a minute, what it should be is, here's how long it should take you to play around. If your card is not keeping up with that pace of play, your card gets the warning. Your whole card. Like, hey, you guys need to pick it up as a card. And then if it's just one player, you can be like, well, it's him. And then it's like, well, it doesn't matter. You guys need to keep going. You guys need to keep up the pace or whatever. And a lot of people don't like that too, because it could be just one player, but at the same time, it's all about pace of play. So what is the correct pace of play for your card to keep moving, so you're not backing up the whole entire place? If you get in the woods and you have a tough lie, if you don't take the proper amount of time to find the right route, to know where the basket is, to know where your layup is, it could take triple the time. You hit a branch right in front of you, rushing your shot, and now all of a sudden you're back in the woods again. And now you take another 30 seconds. You don't have time to go look out. You throw it out of bounds. You re-throw. You throw out of bounds again. All of a sudden you just took 4 minutes because you didn't take your time. You know what I mean? And that's something that people aren't thinking about. But that's for real. When you kick really wildly in the woods, especially on a course like Waco, like, you're in a spot that you have no clue what's going on, and you've never been there. It's not like people are just marching into the woods being like, oh, if I hit this tree, I'm going to go 50 feet in here, and now I got to figure out how to get out. So I think there's a lot of different things, but I think what it comes down to is pace of play for the whole tournament, not just individual players.
Yeah.
Individual players should be allowed to have an allotted amount of time so that they can best perform and give the people who are watching at this point, because that's what it is. It's a product that people need to be able to pay attention to and see and perform and get the best for whatever they're paying for.
And the two things I was going to add to that, Nicholas, is like, for that specific instance where you took, you know, 50 seconds or whatever, if you would have sprinted off the tee pad and gotten to your disc, right, I think the 50 seconds would have not slowed down. Like, by the time you're throwing, the card is probably just showing up. So I think that's another thing, is like, if you know, like, you're going to be the first one to throw on your card, you had the worst tee shot, you're going to be the first one to throw, and you're the last one off the tee pad, and you're like slowly getting that's a major issue. Now, I did want to ask you about the caddy situation. Did you have a caddy during that round?
Round one, I didn't have a caddy. I only had a caddy for the last round.
Okay, and was that Tomas?
Yes.
Okay. I think that also plays a role, because I think when we're watching it live, when I can see your brain and I'm trying to speculate what you're going through. Oh, is he trying to throw like an overstable, like a flex shot to like flat, or is he thinking about maybe throwing a forehand? Like, I'm kind of trying to understand what you're going through, but because you don't have a caddy there and you're not verbally talking it out, I think it feels like a long 50 seconds. Yeah. If you would have had Tomas there and you guys are talking and you're like pulling one disc out and he's like, I don't like, I think for a viewer that 50 seconds goes by super fast. And then honestly too, like I think that's super interesting. Mm-hmm. Like I want to hear that. And so I think that's something too with the coverage of maybe when we do get caddies, maybe when we do get mics to where we can hear you guys, like that to me is, I would love to hear 40 seconds of you breaking that shot down. Like, I think that would be fascinating to everyone. Mm-hmm. So, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. It is going to be an issue because we've had a lot of these tournaments now where we're almost playing glow golf. Did you have a glow disc in your bag just in case?
Yeah, I had multiple. I had like three at least.
Okay, so you were prepared.
I want to say one thing to the 30-second rule. I think that the problem is not if somebody is using like 35 seconds on one shot. There is some people that are slowing, like moving like so slowly on a course. Like, there has been so many times that people throw their tee shots and then we walk to the disc. And then I have been by his disc for like 1 minute and the same guy is still on the tee pad drinking something or eating something or talking to somebody. I think that's the problem. Not like the 35 seconds on one shot.
Yeah, and I'll put it out there. I've played with you a couple times now. You are by far not a slow disc golfer. So I just want to stop that narrative. I don't think that narrative is starting, but if there are people out there being like, oh, he got a time violation, he's slow. No, he's not. He plays very quick. And what I like to call like ready disc golf, of where you know, hey, it's my turn, I'm going to throw, and we're not sitting around waiting. All right, did you happen to see the SportsCenter clip?
Yeah, I saw it.
Okay.
And I heard it.
All right, we're going to play it here because I want to get your reaction. Oh, that link? How much time do you need for it to just pull up? Oh, we don't have a way of just pulling it up real quick? Okay. Oh. Okay, it doesn't have to be like super nice. You can just pull it up literally on like if you want. It's just on Twitter. I just texted it to the group. All right, we'll talk. We'll move on to something else, and then we'll come back to that because I do want to get. I want everyone to hear it first, and then get your reaction on it. All right, let's fast forward a little bit to the final round. Let's go back to the final round real quick. Hole number six. That was one of those holes where the way I thought about it, I thought it was a very well-designed hole because of the shaping of it. And if you weren't able to get clean off the fairway, it was very, very tough to get your second shot to the basket. Were you trying, like, were you thinking about getting to the basket on that second shot there? Because it did look like you threw a fast disc.
Yeah. Thinking about it now, I made a dumb decision on that one. I was going with like PD2, which is like 12 speed driver. I was saying like, not go for the basket, but like skip it like behind the corner and then have like 120 feet to the basket for easy par. I should have just like went with slow disc and just played for like 220 feet. But yeah, that was a double bogey and that one not ideal, and that made me like work harder for the last holes.
Do you like that kind of course design though, of where it's not all like gas? I feel like a lot of courses we play on tour, and I mean, you saw it on this course too a little bit, right? When the wind was down, Gannon shot the course record at 14 under. Yeah. You had some really good rounds as well. You were pretty consistent from round to round, but like, do you feel like all of a sudden those first five holes, right? It's like gas. Like, you got a birdie, you got to try to eagle hole five, and then you get to this hole here and you throw one bad shot and you're like, well, I got to still try to birdie. Like, was that a hard transition in the moment for you to be like, wait a second, like if I just chip, get a par and move on, all things are fine?
Yeah, that was weird because I felt like, as you said, first five holes are like pretty simple, nothing too special on those, and then hole six and hole eight, I think you need to like almost like survive those holes, and you are happy with the par on those holes. And as you can see, like the double bogey happened so fast.
Yeah, it did.
And then again after hole eight, I feel like the end of the course is like pretty simple, and mm-hmm. then maybe 17 and 18 are like more stuff. So it's like mentally pretty hard to go like first play easy for five holes and then go to woods and then come back, and you need to be strong.
Yeah, I didn't really think about it at the time when we were playing, but now looking back and talking about it, like it's actually a really interesting design of where you got to score really good, and then they throw like a speed bump at you.
Yeah.
And then you got to score really good again. And then at the end, it's like, because you can rattle off, I mean, 16, 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, you can eagle. Like you can rattle off a whole bunch right there. And then you get to 17, 18. And if you like slip up a little bit, all of a sudden you can take some big numbers. So yeah. It ended up playing kind of well, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that, for example, I think I had a six on hole six, and Joey on my card had a three. So that was three strokes on one hole. And then hole eight, he took a double bogey and I birdied. So it happened
right
super, super fast. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, that just shows all the commentators out there. This is everyone's big pet peeve when they're listening to commentators. Mm-hmm. Not you, Yuli, the live commentators. It's okay to not have to like be the first one to say the tournament's over. Like it's like a weird like contest. They want to be the first one to be like, oh, that's it. Nicklaus is done. Like as soon as you hit that tree and you go OB, it's like, well, he's done. He's got no chance to win. He's completely out of the tournament. It's like,
yeah.
Hold on, man. Like we're not playing these tournaments where, you know, everyone's shooting 16 under. There are some, you know, score separation here. So hold your horses. I thought you bounced back from that double early. I mean, your round could have been, you know, could have gone the exact opposite direction.
Yeah.
So that was very impressive. Okay. I think we do have the clip now. So for those that didn't see it, this is, your ace on hole 10, and it made SportsCenter top 10 plays. Let's give it a watch.
On number six, disc golf, Linda.
Okay.
This is the Pro Tour, Nicklaus Antilla.
What the heck is this?
On hole 10, 315 feet out.
It's like the pickleball of golf.
Exactly. Just don't take up any real golf courses.
Yeah, exactly.
Got 150 points. He sits in third place.
Good for him.
Okay. So first reaction I want from you is like, Let's act like you saw that in a bar and you couldn't hear the commentary. What was your reaction when you found out that you made SportsCenter top 10? I'm assuming this is the first time.
That was awesome. That's actually my second time. I think I made it. I was also number six in 2022 Tour Finals when I made the long eagle on.
Oh yes. Okay.
15 maybe.
Yes, yes.
So
that was a
time.
Sick shot. Very cool. Okay. I didn't know that made SportsCenter. Very nice.
So, yeah, of course, that's really awesome. I felt like I was pretty lucky, though. It was like too much right, and I was going OB by a mile, but I'm lucky that I went in and I won by one. So that was important.
I think that's literally how all three aces, like if they didn't hit the basket, there was going to be 50 feet right. Okay, let's talk about the commentary now. So I'm blanking on who the commentators, I think it's, gosh, I have to remember what her name is. She's been on ESPN for a very, very long time. Both of them have been. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? And, you know, it wasn't the most positive commentary on that shot. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't really care, but when I think about it more, I think it makes me feel a little bit sad, because if disc golf is somebody's like passion and they really like to do it, and then they hear like somebody talking about it in that way, I don't feel very good about that. Maybe that's the only thing that I have to say about that. Pretty sad.
It's Linda Cohen, by the way. Thank you to Brian for letting me know. Yeah, I'll touch on that real quick. And then Yuli, I want you to hop in because I'm curious what your thoughts are. I think sometimes like this kind of just puts in perspective a little bit because we get in that disc golf bubble sometimes, it kind of puts in perspective a little bit of just like, there are, you know, these massive top four sports. And really, if you're not even in one of the top four sports, you could still be a huge sport.
Yeah.
You still, like, there is still this kind of weird commentary towards a lot of sports that are much, much bigger than disc golf. The way I view it though, because I know, like, you know, you seemed like you were a little sad about it, and there's a bunch of people on Twitter and Instagram that are upset. The way I view it is you're still getting disc golf in front of new eyeballs.
Yeah.
And would it be better if they were like, holy cow, this sport looks incredible. This is the game. Yes, that obviously would be better. But someone still allowed it to get SportsCenter top 10. So at a certain point, like, we still have to be grateful that we got that spot. Now, what do we do to be able to try to get, because Ultimate Frisbee had the same kind of stigma of like, oh, that's like a stoner sport. That's what a bunch of like people that smoke weed and go play Frisbee do. Yeah. And I think it took a long time. And even still, some people think that. I think disc golf is still very young, but Yuli, what are your thoughts on it?
I think it's like a hit and miss, really, with who's announcing it, what they had for breakfast that day. It really is, because they're seeing this and they have to come up with something on the fly. Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes tough, especially with something you probably haven't seen before. There's been times where I've made the top 10 and it was awesome, and there's been times when they made complete fun of me. So one of the clips, they said that I threw it 427 yards, which is like the world record, which is pretty cool. And so that was hilarious, but they like really hyped it up. And another one, they're like, what is this? Frisbee golf. And they like kind of made fun of me in the thing. And I'm with you, Brody, the more eyes that are on it, the better. But I also think we got to give the commentators a little break, because they have a tough job of all of a sudden, they don't probably know what's going to pop up, and they just have to pop
right up.
Mm-hmm. Whatever comes to their mind. And so if I'm doing that, and let's say it's like the throwing marbles world championship, and I have to commentate on something I've never seen before, I'd probably, whatever comes to mind, comes to mind. I don't think we should take it too seriously. Probably.
I don't know. I mean, I haven't watched sports in a really long time, but I don't know if they do it like they used to. They basically would film one, and then I think they would re-record a couple of times. So like, you would get a different iteration of, and the top 10 throughout the day would sometimes change too. Like, some would drop off and new clips from that day would pop in. And so you would sometimes hear the same person, they're now seeing it for the third time. And so I don't know if we have any other clips of that, Nicholas, but you might have another clip from that is a little bit more positive that maybe you can put in your memory bank, hopefully, for you. But no, very cool. I mean, it's always very cool to see disc golf on TV like that. Whether it's in a positive light or not, there are some kids, I'm sure, out there watching that to be like, oh, that looks sick, I want to go try that. So very, very cool to see. All right, let's jump ahead now to hole 14. Now, you know you're not going to end up playing the next two holes, which are pretty much, most of us are thinking those are birdie holes. You're going from hole 14 straight to 17 to 18. You play hole 14 absolutely perfect. You throw a great tee shot, put yourself in a good position. You throw a great upshot to give yourself, what are we calling it, 15, 18 feet?
Maybe 15, 14. It was close.
I was trying to give you the benefit. I was trying to give you the benefit of doubt there, Nicholas. You could have been like, 18, 20.
It was close.
Now, did you do one or two extra pumps there? Like, was that a little bit of a longer routine than your normal putting routine?
Extra pumps. Let's not give them any more breaks.
Did you stand over that putt a little longer than you would normally stand over a 15-footer?
Yeah, a little bit. There was some people moving behind, and that's not like an excuse for that one. It's like 15-foot putt. We didn't make it every time. I knew the scores before that putt, and I knew that if I was going to birdie out, I was going to win by one, I think, at that point, if Kai was going to birdie 18. So I knew the situation, and it kind of reminded me of what happened in Winthrop in 2022. It was actually the same hole as well, hole 14, yep. I think.
Yep. Yeah. And that, to me, like, the
What was going through your mind? Was it the pressure? And so you had all those thoughts, you had the people behind there, and you're sitting there over it, trying to obviously block the negative thoughts out for a second. At what point, because I feel like people who are listening don't understand like the thought process mm-hmm. that goes into situations like that. Like, at what point were you like, okay, this is, I got to pull the trigger. And where was your mind at once you did that? Was it in the right place, or was it just like you rushed it at that point because you didn't take long enough? Because it's okay to sit there and mm-hmm. do 50 pumps as long as you make it.
Yeah. I think I took like a great amount of time. I wasn't rushing anything or stuff like that. I just felt like my head was empty at that time. I felt like I didn't have any nerves, but I wasn't like excited or anything about anything really at that point. I felt like I was just like in that moment, but at the same time I was somewhere else. It was weird.
Now, walking off that green, what's going through your head as you make the walk to hole 17? First off, already kind of a weird situation, right? Because we're normally walking much shorter distance and then off to the right. So now we're doing something that we haven't done, where we're skipping two holes and walking to another hole. What are the thoughts running through your head with two holes to play? And after looking at scores and knowing, hey, if I birdie the last three holes, I win, taking a par there.
And I want to add to that, knowing that there's three holes gone now, being the leader to start the tournament, that could be like, oh, sweet, no more holes. Like, I have the lead and we're getting rid of holes. That's a good thing for me. But at this point, was there any thought of like, dang it, I wish I had those holes back? Just to add to that question.
Yeah, they really took away like the two of the maybe the easiest holes on the course, 50 and 16. Those were pretty simple holes. For me, 17 is like surprisingly easy because I like to throw those flex lines, and I felt pretty comfortable on that one.
We gotta hang out then, Niklas. I was talking before you came on. I was like, that is my least favorite shot to throw on disc golf.
Yeah, I just feel like I'm just like smacking something overstable, and I feel like I almost never miss those shots, honestly. But yeah, I threw it to like 50 feet. It wasn't the greatest shot ever, but I gave myself a look, and that's the number one thing in those situations.
Did you feel like you pulled that tee shot? Because as I was doing commentary, it looked like you threw it and your eyes were like on it, like right away, like, oh no, I pulled it a little bit. Or did you peer it?
It was a little bit too much right and a little bit too low. I think it was like a bit higher. It would have some time to like come back and maybe skip a little bit more on the left. It was a good line, but just a bit too low, I think.
Okay.
Now, the putt you made on 17, that's got to go down as one of the nastiest putts we've seen in a while. You know, it brings me back to like Paul McBeth's putt that he made at Worlds on hole 17, where he's just cashing. I mean, his putt at USCGC on hole 7. We've seen some big putts before. After missing that short one on the previous hole, was it, looking back at it, was it actually nice to have like a 50 footer instead of having like another 20 footer right away?
Yeah. I think I would have taken the 20 footer again, much rather. it was so far, and also it was pretty dark at that time, so I didn't see the basket as good as I maybe wanted to, but I knew that if I want to have a chance to win the tournament, I need to make that putt, and because we didn't have any time for playoff or stuff because it was getting so dark so fast.
Had they mentioned any of that to you guys during the round? Like, were you guys getting updates on what they were going to do? Because so many of you guys were so close mm-hmm. together.
No, I didn't know anything. All I knew that we were going to play 15 holes and that's it.
I wonder if they would have just like brought out some like cars to hole one and just thrown the headlights on the basket. Yeah. That could have been electric.
Yeah, but even if we like tied with Kyle, it would have been like two winners maybe. Is that even a thing?
Oh, yeah. You think they would have just done co-champion?
Yeah, and that's
like they did with Ricky and Calvin that one year. Mm. Legend, I think.
Yeah, I don't want to have like my first win to be like co-champion.
No.
I'll take it.
All right, let's go to hole 18. So you birdie that hole. You're standing, you know, you're walking to the tee pad. Are you looking at scores? Are you seeing where you stand?
Yes, I know the situation. And also, I was playing with Gannon. He told me that, hey, man, he's like, we are always doing this thing. Hey, man, hey, man, you need to birdie 18 to win. Let's do it. And he was like cheering me on and stuff. And I'm really thankful for him. We have been fighting for like a couple tournaments in the past, and it was really nice to see that he's like cheering for me in that moment.
Yeah, and you just absolutely throw the absolute perfect shot on hole 18.
That was beautiful.
Did you was that your play all three rounds to be that aggressive off the tee, or were you a little bit more aggressive knowing that you have to birdie that hole?
I was even more aggressive on round one. I think I threw like PD, and I know now I threw FD, so that's like seven speed.
Okay.
I went OB right on round two, so I was going just like a bit more stable, so I can go like a bit more flatter, and yeah, I threw it very good.
Yeah, it was incredible. And then, like you said, I think the way you ended it with that big, 35 footer, I think that is, to me, that's like the icing on the cake versus, you know, you throwing your upshot to 5 feet. I'm sure you would take both, but looking back at it, knowing that if you were going to make both of them, the 35 footer, let's be real. Like that was epic. The emotion that you showed after making it, like what is all that like going through? I mean, you're not like an old guy. It's not like you've been on tour trying to win forever. So like, where did that emotion come from?
I think there's many things that like affect that moment. I think also the fact that I was second last week and it was so close and I threw OB on 17 and kind of lost the tournament on that hole. And also that there have been so many times that I'm in the backyard putting, and I imagine like, all right, Niklas, this is for the win in a big tournament. And I was just thinking like, if I make this putt, I would be so happy after all those second places and all those close calls and mistakes in the like right moment. So I felt like so relieved, I would say.
Did your phone blow up after you won? Because I mean, what time was it over in Finland? It had to have been super early, right? Were people watching you?
It was like 3 a.m., but all my family, all my friends, they were up watching, and
Cool.
It was absolutely crazy. Yeah.
Wow. That's nuts. That is very, very, very cool. All right. We got a couple. Go ahead, Yuli. Yeah. Go for it.
What about like, so Finland's obviously this country that just loves disc golf. It's so popular over there, and obviously being the best player right now over there, you and Vino.
Mm-hmm.
Who are your like heroes? You know what I mean? To where now you can look at yourself and you can be like, oh my gosh, all these guys before me came and tried to win on the tour and they couldn't do that. And, you know, I'm the lucky one that got to go out there and get this done for anybody. Like who are the guys that you looked up to and you were like, man, I'm never going to be that good. Or I hope I can be that guy someday. Mm-hmm. Like who are the guys that really inspired you from Finland?
There's many guys. I think I would say Seppo is the biggest one for me. He was very good when I was starting disc golf in like 2015 or 2016. Also Pasi Koivu, Jussi Meresma, and even Väinö. Väinö was very good as well when I started, and he still is. And it was funny because Seppo kind of took Väinö to US for the first time and kind of made Väinö feel good in US and stuff. And then Väinö took me to here in 2022, and now I won the tournament for Finland. So it feels like I made Finland proud, maybe.
Not maybe. Yes, you did.
How has that been, you know, transitioning from playing, you know, even in Europe, playing around Europe to now you know, you're not, I don't know how long you're planning on being over here before you go back. Like how is the travel? How is being away from home for that long?
Yeah, I usually do like anything between like 8 to 12 weeks. It's a long time to be away from home and family and stuff. I'm doing like more flying back and forth this year, so I will do 3 trips, and I will actually have more tournaments in US than last year, but I will fly more. And I feel like playing in Europe has been like different for me always, and now I finally feel like the disc golf is feeling same for me in US right now. So It makes me like play a lot better, obviously. I need to think as much, and I feel more like at home in US right now.
What were some of the differences? Like, what were some of the things that made that stood out to you of like, hey, this is different than what it feels like playing in Europe?
I think everything. I'm so far away from home. It's like 15 hours of traveling to get back home. Language is different. You guys don't even understand me all the time because of my English and stuff.
You're doing a great job, by the way. There was a couple comments on here too saying it's very impressive that, you know, your second language, jumping on a podcast and talking with us. So you're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you. Yeah, it's almost everything. Food is different. Almost everything. But I finally feel like I'm almost like playing in Finland, if that makes sense. And it makes me like just focus on disc golf and don't think about anything else than playing the tournament.
We do have Cinnabon here, though, Niklas. We do have Cinnabon.
And Chipotle.
Chipotle. Yeah.
Favorite ones. I like the American food. It's good.
What about this? I really wanted to ask you this question. So coming into like this tournament, you obviously lost the weekend before and you've had some second places. USDGC comes to mind. But you're also playing against the best players in the world. That's one thing that the U.S. does have is the pro tour, right? And so anybody can win any single weekend. And you have these monsters like Ricky and Gannon and Macbeth and Kyle Klein and all these guys. Did you, in your mind, are you thinking like, no, I'm a monster. I'm like these guys. Like, this is where I belong. This is who I am. And like, what is that like playing against them and being like, for example, like you're kind of short in stature and you're a little bit unassuming, and the Finland culture is very quiet and you guys are so humble in your approach to the game, which is nice. Cause then when you win, you know, that electric celebration was awesome for all of us because we see the calm, cool Niklas, and then you win and then the emotion comes out. So I feel like in America, like we're all kind of like a little bit cocky, you know what I mean? All the time. Like we wear our confidence on our sleeves, and it's hard to tell with you guys, like inside is Niklas like, no, I'm a beast. Like these guys can't hang with me, or do you have a lot more respect for their games and stuff? And you just kind of go through a process a different way.
I feel like when I started playing in like 2015, I was watching like all the YouTube and stuff, and I was watching you, Paul, Ricky, all those guys, and they were like so good, so good. And I was like trying to copy Paul's putt or Paul's backhand or anything, and they are like my idols and my heroes. And now that I'm here, I feel like in 2022, I knew that I can do good here, but maybe not win yet. And then last year, I felt like I'm coming closer. And I know that I can win if I do a good tournament and a good weekend. But now I feel more like if I play just okay, I will be in top 10 or top 15. I don't need to like do anything crazy to like be in contention for the win. And that's important for me, because if you get those chances often, you're also going to win some of those. And that's how I look at the game at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was cool. One of the coolest posts I saw was actually from Ricky Wysocki, who had a picture of you kind of looking at him. And then the caption was awesome. It was, welcome to the winner's circle. We've been waiting on you. How did that feel? I thought that was absolutely awesome.
Yeah, that was awesome. Actually, I played my first tournament in US. That was Texas State in 2022. And I was playing with Ricky then, and he said to me that just continue doing what you're doing. You are very good and you will win here in the US. He said that to me in 2022, and I'm very thankful to him. He's like one of the best in the sport to ever play, and he's pushing me forward with that.
That's awesome. That's love so it. Cool. Yeah, I love that, you know, the Pro Tour is still so young, yeah. But we're going to experience more and more of these like cool memories, cool stories of players passing the torch. Like one day you're going to probably do the same thing, right?
Yeah.
You're going to see a new up and comer coming on tour and say something the same. So it's so cool that we're in this spot right now of where, I mean, we've been talking about it on this show of where, you know, heck, 30, 40 people can win any given tournament now. Yeah. And then also like you know, bogey one hole, you're not dropping from third to fourth. You could drop from third to outside the top 10 sometimes. Like yeah. There's so many good players now. It's very, very exciting times for disc golf.
Yes.
All right. A couple listener questions here. They wanted to know, first one is, how did you acquire your unique throwing form?
All right. So, as I said, I was trying to do like Paul McBeth was throwing when I started playing. And in my mind, I felt like I looked just like Paul. And then I was, then I was recording my throw and it was like so different. So Paul has been like a big part of my throwing style. Even though they don't look the same, but I feel like we can control the disc the same way. We throw like, we are not throwing like 95% on every shot. We like tempo down on some of the shots and control those fairway drivers pretty good. So Paul has been a big role model for me, and also Simon I was also like throwing Europe that time, and he was throwing super far, and those two guys are like my main guys when like trying to learn techniques.
Well, that leads me into my next question. This is coming from Kevin. He wants to know, what is your max distance? Really curious how much you can get with that smooth form.
I think I can do like 500, like on a golf line. That's like almost my max. And there's been so many people telling me that you need to throw farther if you go to US and stuff. And I always told them that if I place them on the fairway and make my putts, you don't need to throw like 560 to win those tournaments. Mm-hmm. If you just stay in bounds and do you, I think that's all you need to do.
Germ had a great call about your form. He says that you're rocking the disc to sleep because it's so smooth. I love that.
Oh, you know, that's a good line.
Like he's rocking the baby. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He says that he's rocking the disc to sleep.
Oh my God!
I thought that was amazing.
Very good line. All right, one of fans' favorite segments here. We get to dig in a little bit and really kind of see what gets under your skin. So
all right.
What are your biggest pet peeves?
I need to charge my phone. I have 3%. Oh. I'm bad.
Well, there you go. All good.
All right.
That's a huge pet peeve is when the phone goes dead.
So the question is, what are things either when you're playing in tournaments or casual mm-hmm. rounds or anything, what are some of your biggest pet peeves? Things that like you just can't stand. Mm-hmm. You don't know why they mm-hmm. happen.
Yeah. I think number one might be the like moving slowly, like walking slowly. We spoke about that in the beginning.
Okay.
That's annoying. Then if you don't let like a faster group play through you, or like if there's like four people playing and there's one guy coming from behind, it's annoying if you need to like play behind those. Then, what was the third one? I know I have something that's super annoying.
I just know if I ever get a chance where we're playing, I'm just going to moonwalk to all my discs to really annoy you. Slowly just walking backwards to my disc.
I saw your latest episode and somebody said pump fakes, and that's also annoying, but I do it myself, so I don't know if I can say that or no. That, yeah, that's also annoying. I would say pump fakes. I'm sorry, guys.
No, I think pump fakes are fine. It's just when, like, we were talking about, and again, your putt on hole 14, mm-hmm. that is a different situation than the second hole of a tournament from 15 feet, right? Like, yeah. Those two things are very, yeah. very different, and they should also be, I think, handled differently. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we should be trying to rush the very end of a tournament. Like, yeah. that's when the drama builds. That's when you can yeah. build that story. But if we're on the second hole, brother, and you got a 10 footer and you're like, yes. I'm like, this round's going to be a nightmare. We're in for one here.
Yeah.
All right, Yuli, he kind of answered his question a little bit with the throwing, but there might be another answer here. So yeah. go ahead.
Out of everybody on tour right now, who do you look at? And it could be any part of the game. And you're like, oh man, that's nice. Like, I'm a little jealous of that guy. Like, who do you look at on tour? And you're like, it can be anything.
It has to be AB. He's always AB. Like, yeah.
It's always AB.
I know it's a boring answer, but he's just, when he's throwing far, it's just like, I don't know what's happening. It's like, I can do like half of that, what he's doing. So
yeah,
if I had that, I would be so good.
He also does it in such a way where it doesn't look like the way he looks when he throws in distance contests is vastly different than the way he throws in tournaments, yeah. but he still throws so much farther than everyone in tournaments. So it's like,
yes,
he's got that extra gear that, you know, and you're still watching him just like probably throw 90%. And you're just like, geez, Louise, it just yeah. comes out of that pocket so quick.
Well, and it's yeah. crazy because his down tempo is so good now. Like, he's yes. throwing those Novas and he's just going like walking up three step poof and it's going 350. And you're like, how can somebody who has that much touch mm-hmm. then on the next hole throw it 512 feet on a Spikeiser with a Nuke OS?
Yes.
Like, it's not fair.
Yeah, because I know so many guys that throw like as far as AB does, at least like almost, but they're like, they have no touch. They can throw like slow. And I also feel like AB is like using the distance he has to his advantage on the course. Mm-hmm. And that's a very good one.
All right. I want to leave you before you go here. I want to leave you with a couple stats. This is coming from Edwin Stats here, our statistician. You may or may not know these, but you are actually the fourth European to win an MPO elite event. You are the third player since 2019 to ace and win in the same event. The other two being James Conrad, Worlds 2021, yeah. and Paul McBeth, MVP Open 2020. So that's a nice little group that you're a part nice. Of. And then your 66% birdie rate, that is the highest birdie rate of 2024. Only two players had a higher birdie rate at an elite event in all of 2023. That's Ricky Wysocki, who birdied 68% of the holes at Preserve, and Corey Dolan, who birdied 67% of the holes at Waco. So you birdied a lot of holes this past week, and apparently that's what you need to do to win out here. So keep yeah. doing that.
Yeah, and then you're gonna also double bogey hole six when you do that.
I'm gonna hold that to you. I'm never gonna let you forget hole number six. When you yes. pulled out that driver, I was like, "What is he doing right now?" But hey, sometimes you got to be aggressive to win it, and you clearly did. So, really appreciate you taking the time out of your night to join us on Tour Life. I know all of our listeners really appreciate it, and we wish you the best going forward. Enjoy your week off if you aren't playing anything this week, and we'll see you at Texas States, brother.
All right, thank you, guys. See you in Houston. Safe travels.
There you have it, the 2024 Open at Austin champion, Niklas Antela. Congratulations.
He's just a peach, man.
He was fun to have on.
Isn't he cool?
I've had a couple conversations with him, but nothing like super, super in depth. He's great to talk to. Great. We'll have to have him back on. It was yes. awesome. All right, let's jump into it. So we're going to pull up Edwin's stats now, go through our 2024 MPO Open at Austin event recap. So This was at Harvey Pinnock. This tournament used to be at the Belton, and then it got switched down here, which is now in Austin, Texas. We were playing for a total purse of $76,380. This was the 10th lowest lowest scoring average score to par with negative seven under is where it was at. Was it the average score to par? Let's see what else we got. So this is an interesting one. I didn't realize this, Yuli. So looking at the course from 2023, which was mostly out in the open, okay, to 2024, where they put us more into the woods, people hit the fairways almost over 10% more fairways were hit on average, and also 7% more circle one and greens and regulation were hit. OB rate was roughly about the same, 18% to 19%. And then the birdie rate went up from 30% to 35%. So some people may think like, hey, get us out of, stop having us play in these golf courses, get us into the woods. The course actually played easier on average. It looks like it was an average score of 4 strokes better since 2023. I felt like
it did play easier, but that's because the par fours are 550 feet. I mean, they were, 560, 600 feet. If you stayed in
bounds, right?
Yeah, they're tiny holes.
That was the big thing, is if you could stay in bounds, you were going to score pretty well out there. Okay, what else we got in here? Let's see. Number of players to birdie hole 17 and 18 in the same round, only 14 to do it. And Niklas ended up doing it to beat Calvin Heimberg by 2, I believe, and Kyle Klein by 1. Let's see. Kyle Klein, AB, Gannon continue their top 10 dominance. Calvin Heimberg finally shows up. We've got Kyle Klein finished second, almost becoming the first NPO player to ever win from the third card. That was interesting because they were so much farther ahead than lead that it was a very interesting dynamic of how it all worked out, of where he was just smoking. Like, he was just crushing. It was cool to see. Third consecutive top 10 for Kyle Klein. So he's been sneaky, having a really freaking solid year. And we've talked about it. He might be the most like underrated player on tour.
Yeah, he's gotta be. I mean, when you think about the best players in the world right now, he's not somebody that you put your top 10 together and you might leave him out and then remember and you have to knock somebody else out of there. You know what I mean? He's like very unassuming. A lot of that stuff has to do with personality as well. Mm-hmm. Like,
he's very quiet.
Kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's quiet kid. His interviews are, he does well in interviews, but it's like a little unassuming.
I don't think he's big on social media. Like, I don't see posts popping up on my feed or anything of him doing stuff. So he kind of maybe stays to himself, but his game speaks for it, himself. Oh, yeah, man.
He doesn't have to say anything. I mean, when you think about the complete package, that's what's crazy about his game. Like, his sidearm is so good. It's far. It's accurate. His shot shaping is some of the best in the world. His hyzer flip game's insane. His tight lines are nuts. He throws at 550. And he makes a lot of putts. Like, his putting style also isn't one that you look at and you're like, ooh, that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But when you make it every single time, and he's making a lot of long ones too. If you watch the coverage, like, he's dropping at least one in from 80 feet, it seems like, every single round, which is crazy. His putting is unconscious right now.
We also have AB finishing with another great, great tournament. He finished tied for fourth, third consecutive top five, third best OB rate of the event too, 7.8%. This just shows you AB is not good because he throws far. AB is good because he throws far and is accurate. Like, he is landing in a lot of fairways. He's keeping the disc in play. That is why he's so good. Gannon Burr, another great finish after coming off of a great performance at Waco, finished tied for fourth. Third consecutive top five, and we mentioned it earlier, he shot the course record of 14 under, which I think Kyle might have been able to break that if they were able to play all 18 holes. Because he shot, I believe, 12 under, and the three holes that we pulled out were all birdieable, like were the holes that you want to birdie. So
yes,
he definitely could have tied it, maybe broken it if he would have gotten all three of those. And Calvin Heimberg, you mentioned too earlier in the show of how you kind of tweaked your glute and you weren't able to throw that sidearm and how important that sidearm was. Well, Calvin didn't throw a single sidearm all tournament. And he finished third and had a putt to tie for second. And at the time, tie for the lead.
Which of you guys seen his last shot on 18 to get in position to make the putt? Mind blowing. Like shot of the tournament.
I don't think they did it on live, at least. I don't know about Jomez, but on live, they did not do a good job. They got to get these cameras behind the player just for a split second so we can see the line they're trying to take. Whenever it's like offset, we can't really see that gap. And so for the viewers at home, we played that hole, Yuli. There is nothing on that right side. No, nothing. There are a bunch of like little 3 foot gaps. And I mean, that was the shot of the tournament. Granted, maybe you can look at Nicholas's ace. We probably should give that the shot of the tournament.
You can put the whole tournament where Calvin was, and nobody's getting in the circle or close to it. Or I guess he was just outside the circle, but nobody is.
He also putted really well, 27 of 27, only player to be perfect inside the circle all tournament. So all those people that are, we had a bunch of comments, bunch of questions. When should we be worrying about Calvin? What's wrong with Calvin? Clearly he's going to be fine, guys.
Yep.
He's going to be fine. He doesn't have a sidearm. He's only throwing backhands, and he's still able to play a course that really benefit having a good sidearm. He did just fine. Other thing I want to mention, the wins in round one, I think scores would have been even better had we not gotten that crazy wind. Hole 10 and 11 were just absolute nightmares to try to land in bounds on hole one or day one. Like the wind was, the wind was ripping so hard left to right. I threw, Yuli, it was weird. I threw like an overstable zone at the basket, being like, this thing's going to fly dead straight. Like, I'm just trying to like laser this thing. And it somehow worked itself back. It was like mind boggling. You would see one person throw and their disc would just get shot down. You'd see another person throw and it would get lifted up 100 feet. The fact that some of these guys shot as well as they did in the first round is I don't quite understand how it happened. How did you think the course held up as far as like the water and stuff goes? It rained a whole lot.
It held up pretty good, actually. The only thing that was awful is, listen, they got to figure out these tee pads. Those tee pads were awful. They started drooping in the middle of the tee pads.
Yeah, like let's jump holes to that photo, Silas. If you can throw that photo up real quick. I don't know if you saw all these posts, Yuli. We've got a photo from, I believe it was James Conrad. We've got one of Simon Lizotte, and then we have one from Adam, who are all basically just saying how bad the tee pads were.
I was on that card with Conrad. Like, he,
what happened there?
He just slipped and just absolutely launched.
Bunch of mud? He was covered in mud?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I felt so bad. He was so mad, too. And walking down the fairway, I did the worst thing you could ever do. Because he obviously biffs it, and he's trying to get eagle on that hole, right? That's hole 11.
Okay.
And we're walking up the fairway, and I'm like, yeah, I think you went out right by that sign right there. And he looked at me, because he was in this horrible place, and he looked at me, he's like all surprised, and I'm like, I'm just kidding here. Because there's no way he would have watched his shot, you know what I mean? He hit me with his umbrella. He's like, you son of a... He like hit me with his umbrella. It was a pretty funny thing.
It was crazy. Those tee pads all throughout practice, I thought they were fine. I was a little nervous on a couple of them being a little grippy where my foot kind of caught. Yeah. And for anyone that has knee injuries, that's like the last thing you want to have happen is your knee go this way, but your foot staying behind, or your body going this way, but your knee staying behind. But yeah, once those storms came in, Yuli, those things are not good when the storm, they got all lumpy, I like the frame idea, right? The wooden frame idea, but really, really bad when the front of the tee pad goes down and then up. Like they were basically like a dip. So some scary stuff. We're going to always talk about tee pads because as players, the only time we ever want to feel comfortable is on the tee. That's it. Any other time? Sure, whatever. But on the tee, I feel like that should be like the safe area. We shouldn't be worrying about hurting ourselves.
And then the other thing is that I do get frustrated with, especially on the tour right now, is when we go into a place and they're cutting out new holes a week before the tournament, two weeks before the tournament, and they're cleaning up these places because the roots that are left on the ground, like, scary. And like you'll stub your toe, the mulch was great because I was thinking about this and I was complaining about it. I'm like, this mulch is horrible because there's big old sticks like this big and you've tossed it out of the way with your foot and then three more sticks come up somehow. And you're like, what the heck? And you toss more and then you're just like, okay, this is impossible. But then I was thinking like, if we didn't have the mulch and those sticks everywhere,
it would have been Idlewild. It would have been Idlewild.
It wouldn't have been playable. So it was good that we had it, but at the same time,
what do you want me to give you some good news?
Yes.
They're laying down sod. That's the goal.
That's what I heard. That's what I heard.
They're going to try to make all those fairways grass, which is going to be incredible.
When that happens, it'll be the best course on tour.
It will be absolutely incredible. As far as
like aesthetically, it'll be the best course on tour visually. I think because it's already good. You have the open holes, which are whatever. Even the par five, I felt like filmed really well on camera, as far as being able to see what was actually happening in the distance and everything, especially with the tall grass on the sides and the white stakes. I thought it looked really nice and it didn't really look just a traditional golf course. Nine, I think they could do a better job of nine of clearing right away a spot to where then you could see the fairway kind of go. So it's not just high grass and we're not really seeing, you know what I mean? Like
the par five though, the tough thing there is like, we're throwing our second shots like over the green. Like this is where if disc golf had millions of dollars, that green would be a lake.
Yes.
And now that hole all of a sudden is like, this is one of the coolest holes on tour.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. But if I'm being honest, I think that once they put the sod down and if it works, it'll be one of the best places we play. I still think it's soft. I think the course was really soft. And I think once you put sod down, it'll be even softer. So I hope they don't like 18, they took the OB away on the left hand. I don't know why you would do that. Like leave the OB. Like just leave all the OB. I don't know why they're taking OB and they push the OB farther back on 18. And now if you kick farther in on 18, you get double penalized. It's single penalized.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about OB in the woods. What are your thoughts on, cause I there's pushback. Some people think there shouldn't be any OB in the woods and we should be able to scramble and that's what they want.
It's tough. I think as a course designer, like for example, hole seven has a tree right in the middle of the fairway. Mm-hmm. I love that tree because it's far enough and close enough at the same time for you to be able to shape something the way a disc can actually fly. So it gives you an obstacle right there. I don't think it's very cool looking to me. I don't think it looks good, but the way they're trying to make you shape a shot makes that hole actually pretty difficult to where if you got rid of it, it would just be a gimme. But they placed it at a spot to where it's almost a perfect distance for you to be able to shape from left to right to right to left and vice versa, different ways, whether you're left-handed, you're throwing sidearm, backhand, or whatever. When you get to holes like six, there are trees that don't make a lot of sense on where they place them to where at the end of your flight, you could kick those and go out of bounds where somebody could kick the same tree and stay in bounds. I don't like that.
Yes.
So if you're going to have OB up there, that's random. That's random luck where you get double penalized for a good shot, right?
Hole 14 is another really good example.
100%.
with the OB down the left-hand
17.
Side.
17, great hole. You kick the trees on the left and you go out of bounds left, you deserve it. Yes. That's a bad shot, right? And it gives you enough shot shape distance to be able to control something to go into a green. Now, when you place out of bounds, like I said, on hole six, pretty tight, some good shots go OB. Some bad shots don't. I don't like that. So if they're going to keep making, I don't mind OB in woods if there's no bad trees to kick and there's no roots to hit to shoot you out of bounds. But what happens is it makes the course play short when you take those trees out. Because now people can blast as far as you can, go out of bounds, or be safe and then have a short little upshot. So then you have to make longer holes with no with none of those, I call them bogey trees, in the middle of the fairway. So it's a tough thing. It's up to the course designer to really figure out what the correct distance is, because you can do it. Mm-hmm. If you place a tree like on hole seven, on hole six, it's still a fair shot shape. Just take the other ones out and have OB everywhere. That's fine to me, because if you hit one of those trees, you deserve it.
And this is what I'll say with in regards to OB in the woods. I think it is needed a lot of the time, because I don't think there is any skill in chucking a forehand roller as far as you can. In the woods, I just don't think that's skillful. Like, maybe sure, there is skill in throwing it through a gap and for then it to hit and turn into a roller, but you have no idea where that disc is going to go. You don't know what tree it's going to hit. You don't know what's happening. All you're trying to do is advance it as far as possible. You know what? I didn't really see that often in the woods this week.
Rollers.
I didn't see rollers. Why? Because there's OB, and that's scary. Like hole 18, I bet if there wasn't OB, I think a lot of people throw, maybe even Calvin, if he couldn't throw a sidearm, but maybe a roller becomes a play there, because it's way easier to hit a gap this big when your disc is vertical than when your disc is horizontal. And to me, it's just like, I don't think that's really skillful. I don't like that style of disc golf of just chucking and praying. And the only way to take that away is to add that risk of like, wait a second, like my disc could go OB. And I think Niklas did a perfect example of explaining the difficulty of hole six. I'm with you. I don't know if you need that OB right away on that hole to where you can get screwed, but having that OB for his second shot, like he made a risky play by going for it, and he could have played it a much different way. Yes. I like that. I like seeing having to play, what should I do here, versus like, this is the only play.
I also think that 17 and 18 were perfect finishing holes, because it made you do the exact opposite shot back-to-back tee shots.
Yes.
Like, you have to have the skill of pulling the disc from left to right off of a tree and getting it to flex out. And then the next one, you have to throw a subtle hyzer flip, complete opposite shots. I really like the idea behind that.
Yes. All right. Let's see here. What is this? This is...
I don't know. What is that?
Oh, I think he just added on. All right. I think that's the end of the Edwin stats.
Podcast. All right. Later.
I know we jumped around a little bit, but shout out to Edwin stats. I think that is going to do it for that segment. And I do want to mention one thing. I made a tweet that said, best part of my tournament was not showing up late to my tee times. I think people, you know, everyone's going to view, if you like me, you're going to view that as, that's a funny joke. Brody played terrible. He's making a joke of, he played so bad that the best thing he did was show up on time. Right. And then if you don't like me, you're going to look through it as a lens of me basically like poking fun at people showing up late, however you want to do it. Holly Finley ended up showing up late. She made a comment saying that in 12 years, in 278 events, this was the first time she's ever showed up late to a tee time. That's a crazy stat. But my question to you, Yuli, is we've seen it now at every single tournament. Do you like that there is a 2-stroke penalty, or do you think we should do a fine? or like maybe a percentage out of
your cash. It is a fine
in a way, I guess. For yeah. Sure.
I don't think it. Listen, you show up late to your tee time at this point, like something had to have happened. You lose track of time. You should get a 2-stroke penalty. Like at this point, there's been enough people who've gotten stroked.
Everybody's talking about it.
Every time I show up to the starter tent, I go, "Hey, I'm here." Like, and I'm 10 minutes early just to make a joke. Like it's getting old, right?
They might need to start stroking people for showing up too early.
Maybe
because it's starting to get kind of crowded up there, Yuli. Yeah, you're like you have people that are teeing off two groups behind you already showing up.
I'm fine. I'm in the same boat. I don't think we should have a freaking 5-minute tee time. I don't. I really don't. I think it's silly.
Oh man.
I don't think that we should have. Like I gotta be careful because I almost slipped a naughty in there, but
no, it just okay.
makes me. It You're makes me it so be frust- real. Yeah, Raw. It makes me so frustrated that they think we need to again. It was the
we
announcer.
We do though,
was
Yuli.
Awesome. No,
we
no,
do
listen,
need
the
it because there's three
awesome.
People now every tournament that haven't showed up on time.
We don't need it. That's 5 minutes. They don't need to be there. But anyways, they don't need to be there 5 minutes. The guy again told me about the.
Oh, I knew you were going to love that.
He told me
about
the
Flymart. I knew you were going
to
love that.
Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, dude, I'm about to tee off for my freaking tournament. I don't care about what's happening.
But you can bend for free, Yuli. You can bend for free.
Yeah. I also probably got an email saying that I could do that. And I don't need these announcements. And I don't, you know what they need to start doing? I'm going to be honest. If you're showing up that early, make it productive. Get a couple interviews from the people or something. You
Ooh,
know what I mean?
Hate that.
Like have a guy sitting that. There and be like, "Are you ready for your vote?" Throw some extra in for the live or whatever. But don't just make me. I'm sitting there for 4 minutes doing nothing, watching the card in front of me tee off.
Electric
We're
stuff.
We're not doing anything. 4 minutes.
You do need that 5 seconds to put the code in for your PDJ live score.
My code's always in there. Like, and
you're pre-coded. You're right. You're showing up pre-coded.
It's just so frustrating. But anyways, do I think people should get stroked? Yes, it's a rule. Stroke everybody who doesn't show up on time. Do I need to be there 10? I'm there 10 minutes before so I don't get stroked. If I show up exactly 5 minutes, that's pretty risky business. I'm not going to do that. So now
I'm that 7 to 8 range.
I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be there 5 minutes before my 5 minutes because the strokes are important.
Yes.
And it's silly. Why am I there 10 minutes before my tee time? It's a silly thing. But anyways,
Frank, one of our Tour Life crew members, shout out to all our Tour Life crew members. We really appreciate the support. He just in the chat said, "Yuli, jump up and talk into the live cam they had going." So I guess you could technically have your own interview because
we did. Silas and I jumped up there and Silas was telling them to go get some merch and stuff. And so
you can just have your own interview, I guess, on there. Maybe
you
maybe
gotta
we'll...
be careful what you're saying there too.
Yeah, it's a hot mic.
If you're having a personal conversation on the tee, you're live right there, bro.
Be like, "Yeah, I'm staying at blah blah. My room is 138.
they
just
don't
come
want
on
you it. Talking about the code too, because then people are gonna get in the code for the live. They're like, "No, you gotta look at this. I can't say it out loud." I'm like, "This is a mess, guys. What are we doing?"
Oh man. All right, let's see here. What do I want to jump to? Let's go to FPO. I think we're ready to talk about some FPO here.
All right.
So intern David roasted me a little bit with this tweet. He said, "When Brody didn't include Owen as a top threat to Kristen, threw up the Michael Jordan. I took that personally." I'm gonna first say it. Owen owned me. All right, Yuli, to give you credit, I was listing off the players that could potentially beat Kristen. I left Owen out of that conversation. And you quickly jumped in. You're like, "Don't forget about Owen." And I was like, "Oh my gosh." I stand corrected. Owen showed this week just why her name should be at the tip of all of our tongues when we're talking about the best women disc golfers in the world. She didn't just go out and beat Kristen Zatar. She went out and laid a smackdown on everyone. An absolute smackdown.
This is the proof that putting is the great equalizer. It is in our sport. If you go out in any division and you just make everything and you just keep it in bounds, like, you're going to have a chance to win. And I don't think this is going to be the last time Owen wins this year. Like, I really don't. Like,
I do. Go ahead.
We watch Kristen. You know what she does? She throws consistent shots right down the fairway both ways, and she makes a lot of putts. She's not doing anything special.
That's what Owen did, but she just did it a lot better this week.
Yeah.
Now, I do stand by what I said of where I do think some of these courses, I don't know if she has the disc, because yes, putting for sure is the great equalizer, but if you're only able to throw to the back, like throw inside a circle two on 12 holes, and you're playing against people that can throw inside a circle two on 18 holes, you're at a massive disadvantage. We talked about it. This course had a lot of short par fours. This was not a long course by any means. This was a short course. A
lot of sidearm flex shots too.
A lot of sidearm flex shots in the woods that she was throwing beautifully. So I'm curious to see, and I don't know the FPO layouts that well, like off the top of my head. I do a decent job going into the tournament knowing, but right now I don't know what are the long courses on tour for FPO. If she can get it done at one of those courses, then I think that narrative drops and she can win at every event. But right now, I'm still under the thing of where I put her at 1B, right below Kristen, at a lot of these short courses.
Yeah. I don't know. She won by a lot, bro.
I know, man. That second round was wild. That second round was insane.
The thing is she, at least Kristen got second. If Kristen would have got third, we'd be talking about, oh, she didn't have this. And I heard some stories about her having some sort of
injuries or something.
Injury. Yeah. Like, calm down. If she was playing 100%, Owen wins the tournament.
Yeah, it's tough to look at that and say that Owen was going to get beat.
You win by a billion?
You won by 11, I believe.
Yeah, she wins.
Is that what the final?
I think it was. I think it was 11.
Let me see here. She ends up winning by 11. She shot 10 under the final round. Kristen played well the final round, shooting 8 under. Round 2, she shot the insane round, 13 under with a bogey. Kristen ended up struggling a lot in round 2. Kristen actually tripled hole 18 to end up shooting 2 under. And then round 1... Owen actually didn't get off that well. Owen only shot 3 under round 1. So yeah. It just looked like, you know, Owen had 2 incredible rounds. Kristen had 1 good round and like 2 rounds.
What I'm going to say though is, if we've seen this in sports, if Owen just figured it out how to keep her disc in bounds, like she just did it this weekend, right? She has the winning formula. And she doesn't play that good, she might be able to keep up with Kristen. You know what I mean? If she's just found that little avenue of being like, okay, I'm going to throw these consistent shots, I'm going to make some putts, blah, 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 blah. I don't know, man. I don't think the distance is really that big a deal.
We're gonna find out next week, because Edwin's pulling the stats. He's saying it right now. He's going to go back and pull the stats. I can't wait.
Me too. I'm excited to see. At least there's somebody challenging her. And not only challenging her, at least Kristen didn't win every tournament. I think I said last week for sure she wasn't going to win every tournament. And now we can stop with that, because at a point I was thinking Kristen might win every tournament.
I thought so too. And Edwin also let us know too that Harvey Pinnock is the 5th shortest course on tour for the men. I think sometimes people just look at the distance and they think like, oh my god, 11,000 feet, holy cow. So you got to look at the par, because if it's 11,000 feet par 54, that's a freaking long course. But if it's 11,000 feet par 70, that's not a long course at all. That just means we're playing a bunch of par fours that are 600 feet. So you got to look at the par, guys. Don't forget about the par. Okay, let's see. What else do we got? FPO. Des Redding. I believe this was her first time doing commentary. Fantastic. We get her in the booth more, please. She made a comment about something along the lines of like, if you're taking a shot every time Owen makes a putt, you might want to start thinking about switching the juice. I thought that was hilarious. I thought she did a fantastic job.
You did awesome. I did too.
Knowledgeable, knew when to talk, when to be silent, build the moment. Really, really liked Des Redding. So hopefully she is back in the booth. Katrina Allen had a slight, we've been talking about her. I mean, she's pregnant, but she had a little bit of a, oh, maybe she's back. So we'll kind of keep an eye out on that. Paige Pierce. What are we thinking here? Did she come back too soon? Or do you think if she's not doing anything right now, that could potentially put her in more harm? She's just getting the reps back, getting the rust off. Like what's your mindset on her?
I think she's just getting the reps back. It doesn't seem like she's in a lot of pain. Looked like she was playing and I didn't see her like, you know, struggling to get around the course. Listen, she snapped her leg in half.
No, I know.
Like, it's not like she's just like, you do that, do a little rehab and then you're back. You know what
I
mean?
My question though is like,
you've gone through how many knee surgeries? It takes a while to get your confidence back in an athletic sport. And now if this lasts, let's say 10 tournaments, we got problems, but I don't think it will. I think the first three tournaments, five, six tournaments, you should be able to gain confidence, learn how to score, do the thing. She's a world champion. I don't think we worry about that yet.
Yeah, she ends up shooting 76, 66. So she had a decent round two, and then 76 as well to finish the tournament at 20 over par, finishing in 40th place. So, yeah, my only concern here is as long as she didn't come back too soon and she's putting herself at risk of not getting back to 100%. But if this is just something like, hey, I'm able to play right now with no risk of injury, I'm able to play without messing myself up more, then I think I'm fine with these bad results because she'll slowly work herself back into it.
Yep.
And, you know, hopefully by the end of the season or in a couple months, like you said, we can see when she's playing well, we can see her back at the top of the leaderboard, pushing Kristen and Owen and everything. Anything else stick out to you from FPO?
Nope.
Okay. Other thing I wanted to say too, I think in disc golf, there are two elements. There are the element of being in the woods and having hit lines. And then I think the other element is being in the open and having to control the skip, control your angle. And then also it is a skill when you're in the woods and you've got a gap in front of you, 200 feet, you've got a target. I got to throw it through there. When you're out in the open and there's no trees that you have to manage, there is a skill involved of like, where am I aiming this? Like, how far do I want to swing it? Like I struggled on hole one, the first 2 days, because my target line was not good. It was too inside. And so I kept skipping and going like 30, 40, 50 feet left. If there was a tree, like two trees that we had to throw through to get to that basket, that's a much easier shot if I'm struggling with my my aim point, because it's like, I have to throw through this and then the disc will work its way over to the basket. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think sometimes people are like, we need to get in the woods. I think there is an element of disc golf that takes a skill of being able to throw out in the open with OB.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you have to visualize what you're doing at what distance. And when there's no trees, it's definitely a little bit harder. And that's where the field work comes in. When you're in the field, you better be visualizing like trees in your way and shot shapes and everything, release point, all those key ingredients and throwing good shots. One thing that I try to do, and I'm obviously not the farthest thrower, but when I'm doing field work, I'm throwing as far as I can, but I'm visualizing like trees on both sides and peeling them off of certain spots so that I have just a tight flight. That way, wherever I'm aiming, I'm throwing the same flight pretty much. Like I always want to do like a power left to right drifting, barely maybe like a 15 foot drift from right to left on all shots. If you can do that, if you can throw a 450 foot straight shot, you just change your disc and then it just comes back and skips and bounds. Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Does disc golf have a weather problem? So we've talked about it a little bit. We didn't end up playing three holes the final round. We skipped hole 12, 15, and 16. We ended up only playing 15 holes. I actually made a tweet about this. I think I found out about it way before it was announced to the public because I think people were thinking it was, oh, here comes Brody again trying to change disc golf. I was literally saying, like, why do we play 18 holes? Right? Because when they were like, hey, you're only playing 15 holes, it made me think, like, for all those people that are telling me, Brody, stop trying to make disc golf more like golf, this is where you should be jumping in on my side. Why are we playing 18 holes? 18 holes is a golf thing. That is what golf decided they were going to do. A front nine, a back nine. Why does disc golf have to play 18 holes? And this is a legitimate question. Like, can we play 10 holes? Can we play 12 holes? Can we play 15 holes? And if your argument is, well, there's not enough score separation, I have two things to counter that. One, we just played a three round tournament. We played 54 holes. Last week, we played 72 holes. So we played way less holes here, and there was still plenty. No one was saying, oh, we need another day. There's not enough score separation. So if we play a four round tournament and we play 12 or, you know, 13 holes a day, that's 52 holes. That's almost the same amount of holes of a three round 18 hole tournament. And then if your argument's like, well, we need more holes that you play in one day with score separation. Nicholas was just on here telling you that hole 12, the holes they removed, 12, 15, and 16, the top guys are all birding that hole. So those holes almost don't even exist to begin with. Like those aren't real holes. There aren't really score separation holes. Yeah. You're not bogeying that. So what are your thoughts on that? Do you ever see that we could change from 18 holes to 12 holes? And now rounds are taking an hour and a half.
I mean, you could, but I mean, it's just the way that the game's played. It's like saying, okay, I love tennis, but let's play tennis on a pickleball court. Like,
No. It'd be more like, hey, instead of doing these best of five sets, let's do best of three, which they do end up doing. So I guess it's equivalent to what we're doing where some tournaments are four rounds versus three rounds.
That. Yeah, we still do that. But
question, can I have another counterpoint?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I think limits a lot of times course design is space. They have to put 18 holes in this amount of space, and we don't have a lot of space. What if we could put 10 really freaking good holes? And again, I actually don't even know if I like this idea. I'm just throwing out, why are we locked in on 18?
I think it's just so connected to golf. Like when you say golf, it just 18 is the thing. I don't think there's any other reason besides that.
So everyone that's coming after me for trying to make disc golf more like golf needs to come after Yuli and say, we're not golf, Yuli. We're disc golf. We're going to play four holes now.
Yeah, no, I don't.
It's an interesting thought.
It's an interesting thought for sure. I mean, I would much rather play 14 holes that are great than 18 with four holes that suck.
Yeah.
I would rather use the land for that. But I mean, I guess on the pro tour, it really shouldn't matter. I think in smaller tournaments and stuff, when you're doing like shotgun starts, you can have more people in the tournament. That's one reason. Mm-hmm. But other than that, no.
We played 20 holes at De La a couple years ago.
Yep, I would much rather have like better holes for sure.
The other thought is too, like, I think the Disc Golf Pro Tour does have a weather problem. I think they literally do. I don't think they have a good solution. I think just taking holes out, it worked for this tournament. And luckily the tournament was really exciting. I don't think you're necessarily going to get that every single time. So I don't know what they can do differently. You know, Jeff did mention that maybe starting on finishing on Monday, but the big issue here is you're having two tournaments a lot of times on one course, right? We're having the FPO tournament and the MPO tournament.
So I've been thinking about this a lot, and everybody says go to Monday. What I've been thinking is when you see the weather being so bad Saturday, Sunday, Friday, why not start on Thursday?
Ooh.
Like, we're already all there. Like, why not start on that day and then play, and then we're just done on Saturday, or we have a buffer day to where maybe we can get the rest of them in.
So or these are start a lot
on
of
Wednesday.
Yeah, you know these what are I mean?
Because we're already there. That's all I'm saying.
I see what you're saying. I would argue some people are going to come back to you, or I would say some people are going to come back to you and say that everyone is going to be there, which is valid. It's getting smaller and smaller. It's
more of a, they're probably going to be there compared to Monday. And if we all knew it, like, hey, this is the rule. If there's weather coming up, they send an email and they're like, okay, possible start on Wednesday, then we kind of know. You know what I mean? Instead of just having two round tournaments or whatever, yes. I feel like that would be easier than us right now as we sit pushing it to Monday.
Let me throw out two other ideas as well. First one, let's just start cutting the field. Let's get cuts. Like, there's no reason I need to play that final round.
We should just start asking people, are you going to DNF this weekend? You're done. If you DNF, you're done.
Just I was going to say, let's play around with cuts. And also, they have now shown precedent that you will be able to play in threesomes. They send out threesomes. When someone DNFs and the foursome is no longer, they have sent out threesomes. The second day, I want to say, there was two threesomes in front of us. So my other thing is, let's make more threesomes. Make a cut and make almost every card in front threesomes so you can literally fly through these rounds. So those are the other two things. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what ends up happening, but this is an issue. It is a problem. Imagine, Yuli, if we're at USDGC, and they're like, all right, we're not going to play. Let's imagine something crazy happened where you had people already play some holes, right? To where they're like, all right, we can only cut these last four holes. And they're at USCGC. They're like, all right, for time, we're not going to play 16 and 17 final round. Do you know how crazy that would be if you're not playing 17?
I mean, they cut a whole round at USCGC once.
Okay. All right.
Wait, final okay. round.
Let's not throw rocks at Big Germ over here. But yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's, I don't know. It's something that needs to be solved. I don't know what the solution is. I threw out a couple ideas. You threw out some ideas. It'll be interesting to see where the Pro Tour goes.
The key ingredient is Monday. We play on Mondays. If we don't get the tournament in, you just play it on Monday.
Which I think is fine for a lot of places. This place would be tough when you have a kid's golf camp taking precedent over the practice rounds.
That's all hogwash, because if this is a rule, it's not going to be instated this year. It'll be next year, right? Instated beforehand.
Sure. I'm just saying, like, yes. How much extra money is it going to cost to tell the golf course, hey, we might need to use Monday as well? Like, do they have to put more money down to secure that? For that to potentially maybe. Happen. Yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see the legit. Hey, maybe Jeff Spring will come on the show. We've asked him. Maybe he'll come on the show and answer some of these tough questions. All right, let's move on. Lori Lehtinen, one of the better European players, makes a post on Instagram this week announcing that he will not be touring for some time. He said, I experienced the worst mental game challenges I've ever had in Waco. Because of this, I decided to leave the U.S. for a while to rebuild the pieces together. As much as it hurts to leave the tour, this was really the only option I had. Thank you, everybody, for the support. Kind of a big news. Like, he's a big European player. He's had some really good finishes on tour. So sending him all the best. And hopefully he can figure it out and come back on tour better and stronger.
Yeah. Get your mind right.
Shout out to Schwebby. Schwebsters. Schwebby takes down his 400th PDGA Pro event. 400. Schwebby sometimes is in the chat. I know he listens to this podcast. So I do want to give
a guest on the podcast before.
Guest as well on the podcast. Big shout out to Schwebby for taking that down. Incredible. 400 wins. Wow. That's do you think you'll ever get to that number, Yuli?
No. Absolutely not. Nor will I try.
I was going to say, you would have to put some major effort just playing like a C-tier event every week.
I think I could get to 200 by the end of my career, which could be a goal, which would be pretty cool. 200 is very nice,
especially if you could retire with a win on number 200.
Oof. Oh, that'd be sweet.
That would be very nice. Kona star Montgomery announces on Instagram this week as well that she will make her return this week at the U.S. Women's Championship. This is 6 months after finding out that she had thyroid cancer. So she's kind of been on the fence. I've been paying attention. She's kind of been on the fence on these last couple of events of whether or not she wanted to come back. And she seems like she's taking the required time to feel like she's 100% coming back. And so
love that.
We will see her at the first major of the year next week and wishing her all the best. Let's jump into the wild story of the week. This week is from Tanner. Tanner says, there's a little pitch and putt course at a local elementary school where I live. I thought it would be a great place to take my 7-year-old to throw around and play. I was going well, but the first sign of trouble was when I threw a zone and a gust of wind picked up and dropped it on top of the school. Bye-bye zone. On the next hole, I'm trying to explain to my sweet child that he doesn't need to full send a putt. My kid just starts spinning in circles as a result. I'm standing about 3 feet directly behind him, and I decide I'll let him do his spins, and then we will revisit the putting conversation. As he makes his third spin, the disc launches out of his hand and hits me directly in the eye. Oh my gosh. I fall down, trying not to yell obscenities and further scare my child, who is concerned he has killed his father. The disc hit my eye hard enough to knock out my contact. Oh my gosh, been there. I'm very blind, and I had to drive us back home with only one functioning eye. Yikes. Thankfully, the damage is pretty minimal, and I just had a gnarly black eye. But it's a good reminder that nowhere is safe when a defiant 7-year-old is holding a putter.
Oh, that's good stuff.
We got to get some coverage of like youth disc golf. That would be electric. Like under 10. Like you know how they do the Masters is coming up and they do that drive chip putt. Is it drive chip putt?
Might be.
That doesn't sound right either.
Chip.
chip putt drive. Oh my gosh. I don't know. Okay. Whatever it is, they do that. It's always fun to watch before the Masters. That would be kind of cool to do like a little event like that before USDGC or something. Another idea for free for you guys out there. Take it how you will. All right.
I mean, they do have a lot of kids going out there to the edge. Tons. At USDGC. Yeah. So they have that little drive chip putt area.
Yeah, a lot of kids out there, a lot of kids for the European Open. Really cool to see a lot of kids at these events. All right, we've got one here from Dark and Stormy. A couple listener questions before we wrap up the show. Dark and Stormy wants to know, is 1 month too long for the Pro Tour to spend in just one state?
Too long?
Yeah, he's asking, is it too long?
I don't care where we go, as long as they're good courses. I really don't. I mean, as long as I'm not going from Massachusetts to Washington, I'm good.
Yeah, I think I had an argument on debate night. Pitch, putt, and drive? That doesn't sound right either. Chip, putt, and drive? It's definitely not pitch. Chip is definitely in there. Someone's got to look this up and tell me, please. I had an argument on debate night, I think it was last week, where I was saying, like, listen, if Charlotte is like the biggest hub of disc golf, and Charlotte is going to show out, because we've seen it in other sporting events, right? Like if you're a huge Carolina Panthers fan, just because there's back-to-back home games, that doesn't mean like, oh, I'm not going to go to this home game. I just went to the last one. There's season ticket holders. There's tons of people. So I've always had the argument, the tour should go to where the best courses are with the biggest fan base. That's just where we should go.
Yep.
Where are the good courses? Where are people going to show up? And if that's like Charlotte, we should have four events in Charlotte. I don't care. Like, if there's four really good tournaments and we're going to have thousands of people show up to each week, I'm down with that. Like, let's not go to some random place in the middle of nowhere and have 50 people show up. I don't see how that's a good thing.
Agreed.
All right. Last question here comes from Demon on Twitter. He said, you teased Tour Life Disc on the last pod. Any update or info on that? Well, Demon, we've got good news for you, brother. Yuli's got him right here in hand. Look at that. We've got a Tour Life. I believe that's a Jawbreaker Zone. Then I believe we have a Tour Life. Is that the ESP Buzz, I believe?
This is the Raptor.
And then the Z Raptor, I believe, is the other one.
This is the Zoner. Or no, this is the Buzzer.
Yeah, the Buzz. And I think that's the Jawbreaker Zone.
Yeah.
And as of right now, the stock is going quick. We only have 22 Buzzes left, 25 Raptors left, and 22 Zones left. So if you want to support the show and get out in the course throwing some Tour Life discs, go over to foundationdisc.com, pick them up. I think I'm going to do a video soon where I only play with those three discs. So that could be fun. Okay, Bobby says drive, chip, and putt.
Yeah, that's it. Drive, chip, and putt.
Drive, chip, and putt. That's what we're going with. Okay. This
makes
is like
sense.
One of those, this is like one of those things where like you just completely forget something and nothing is clicking. Nothing has clicked yet. All right. Tour Life Crew, shout out to all our Tour Life Crew members. The chat's been amazing. Thank you guys so much. Silas, where are we at on the Tour Life merch update versus Grip Locked? How are we looking?
All right. Yeah. So Tour Life, let's go Grip Locked. Grip Locked is at 220.
Okay, they went up a lot
and
last week.
Tour Life is at 259.
Ooh, baby. Okay. Getting close to 300. If you're looking for some sweet Tour Life merch, if you want some hats, if you want some shirts, if you want some hoodies, head over to foundationdisc.com. Check out all the Tour Life merch. Always cool to see it on tour, too. I always notice I was going to say another really bad analogy, and I don't know what's going on with my brain. It's over 2 hours. That's why these podcasts normally go right about 2 hours, because my brain starts shutting off after this.
Done.
So maybe it was a good thing that Owen didn't come on, because it would have been the last part of this podcast could have been an absolute disaster. So we'll definitely have to have Owen on at some point. But shout out to Nicholas. Congratulations again. Congratulations to Owen as well. Shout out to Schwebby. Shout out to Yuli. Shout out to Silas. Shout out to Edwin Stats. Grant, our social clips guy. David, our intern. Everyone that makes this podcast work. And shout out to all you guys listening, our viewers right here, whether you're on our YouTube live or listening to us on Spotify or Apple. Thank
Hit
you guys.
That like and subscribe button right
Ooh,
now.
Yuli, you give it to them, baby. Let's go. Like and subscribe. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next week.